One of the things that I think that we failed at, right, is like we got folks really upset and then we didn't tell them what to do about it. Folks are more aware, but there's a level of fatigue and there's also a level of disempowerment in that knowledge.
That's Nathan Sheard, also known as Nash. Nash is the managing director of advocacy at the Electronic Frontier Foundation, a decades-old grassroots nonprofit that has been at the frontier of privacy, freedom of expression, and innovation through activism, policy analysis, and technology.
Like what happened to the Muslim communities in New York and New Jersey post 9/11, right? When they were just being so surveilled, they stopped having conversations internally. Like the repression was so effective, right? It is critical that we be able to say like, not just like, here's the problem you need to know about, but it's also like, there has to be an empowering piece of it too. That's the challenge, right? Making sure that folks aren't just aware, but that they feel like there's something they can do.
In this episode, we'll get insight into how the Electronic Frontier Foundation has become a leading voice in online rights and how Nash, through his work at EFF, is helping to empower people all around the world. We'll learn how protest, grassroots activism, and a historic moment inspired him to advocate and defend those in need in the real and the digital world.
3, 2, 1.
I'm your host, Ted Vaughn, co-founder at Historic and author of Culture Built My Brand. Join me as we unpack the stories and lessons of today's most innovative leaders. Nash's story begins in his home city of New York, a place he loves for its culture, musical heritage, and an uncontainable energy that guided him towards activism early in his life.
I had been involved in like more traditional political party organizing in my early adult life, but I had left that and kind of, you know, I spent, you know, 10 years in the music industry and became a commercially rated pilot and like was looking for like, what is the thing that I'm going to do? And around that time in 2011, the Occupy Wall Street movement broke out in New York, and I was still, you know, still living in New York. And for a significant amount of time, I wasn't one of those folks that was like there on September 17th and was like immediately like, yeah, this is what we need to do. That wasn't me. I was hearing about it. I heard folks that, you know, lived down in Battery Park City. I had lived down in Battery Park City for a while, but had since moved, but who were like saying negative things about the folks that were there. I heard other folks that were like, I can't believe that this is happening. This is such a moment, you know, an important moment in history.
Of activists mad at the 1% and taking aim at Wall Street, not the great GameStop short squeeze, but Occupy Wall Street, which started 10 years ago. Back then, hundreds of protesters took over Zuccotti Park in Lower Manhattan and marched to the financial district. The movement would last 59 days, but its ripple effects would stretch for years.
For those who might be too young to remember, Occupy Wall Street was a grassroots movement fueled by public distrust of the private financial sector during the aftermath of the Great Recession and bank bailouts of 2008.
But I eventually, like, you know, happened to be in Lower Manhattan, went down to the park there and watched what they call the General Assembly. And it was like, you know, at that time, like hundreds of people in this park and like talking about things that like, for a long time, to be quite honest, I would look at some of the issues that they were bringing up as far as like economic disparity and otherwise. And I kind of felt alone in like being like, how come no one sees this problem? Like, why isn't anyone like enraged about this problem? And then to be in that space and be like, oh, like folks actually get it. And so I've just, you know, began to come back more frequently and eventually became involved with facilitation there and some direct action planning. But I would say like that was the moment for me. It was about the issues, certainly about the issues, but it was also about the community that was being built there. And there was that connection to the community that kept me coming back and having that community around you and that support around you and that folks who had a hope and had a dream of what something that could be and were willing to plant seeds even if we never could sit in the shade of those trees was just a really meaningful moment for me.
The protests and its slogan, "We are the 99%," fueled an international movement and planted a seed of activism and advocacy for Nash. It was also his introduction to the Electronic Frontier Foundation, or EFF for short. Working alongside other volunteers and activists, planted seeds that quickly grew, guiding Nash towards a new chapter in his life.
So originally, you know, from showing up in the park, and especially it was the way that they went about organizing, come to decisions, that initially caught my eye. And so I began becoming part of the facilitation working group, which is a group that kind of led a lot of those big meetings and made sure that folks were able to communicate in really effective ways. As I began to spend more time in Zuccotti Park, or Liberty Square as we called it, and with a lot of more activists, it was very clear that that entire park was surrounded by surveillance cameras, police cranes, officers with cameras. So that was my initial awareness of some of the issues that EFF works with, especially around our surveillance self-defense. And then as that continued, I eventually, you know, because of the fact that I had been arrested for protest, I was involved with organizing that actions where other folks were arrested, I started to feel more of a responsibility to make sure that people were taken care of for throughout the duration of their involvement with the criminal system. So that kind of moved some of my activism from being a direct action organizer and facilitator to being more a legal support organizer. And providing that support, it meant that we had to collect a lot of information that was really sensitive information. And it was necessary that we were responsible stewards of that information, because obviously if that information was in the wrong hands, it could be potentially harmful to the folks who we wanted to be supporting. So there was two different angles of there's one is the kind of surveillance that people experience in the streets. And then there's also the need to really have an understanding of encrypted communications and encrypted data storage and what have you. And so that's kind of where I began to first be more aware of EFF, and then also how I began eventually working with them, because part of that work, that legal organizing work, more and more of it became also around doing digital security trainings and making sure that people that I was working with, that I was supporting, knew the things that they needed to do to do the very basics of being able to share information with each other in responsible ways and being able to store that information responsible ways. At some point then, some of the folks that I knew that were working at EFF, we started to do trainings together. And so that's kind of when I originally started working for EFF, not as, you know, as an employee, but rather as a collaborator. And then when I was in North Dakota supporting the folks at Standing Rock, there was a position that, you know, one day I was just looking and there was a position that opened up to be a grassroots advocacy organizer for EFF.
EFF was established in 1990. In fact, one of its founders, the late John Perry Barlow, rancher, poet, and lyricist for the Grateful Dead, wrote an account of the very day he says it started. It was May 1990 when an FBI agent knocked on Barlow's door in Pinedale, Wyoming. The agent had traveled 100 miles from his office in Rock Springs, Wyoming, guarding a stack of documents he'd received from San Francisco for a case on data crime. But this agent was more accustomed to regional crime and livestock theft, not data crime. Now he needed to find out if valuable source code from Silicon Valley giant Apple had been stolen and whether Barlow was involved in any way. Barlow was surprised by the visit, but he ended up spending hours discussing data crime with the FBI agent. The visit alarmed and worried Barlow, but it also motivated him to post about it on an online bulletin board. Because remember, this was 1990. That post about the agent and the FBI's struggles to apply outdated laws in the embryonic digital world rallied his fellow founders, Mitch Kapoor and John Gilmore. And it rallied many more people to the cause, all of them concerned that civil liberties, privacy, innovation, and intellectual property all posed serious questions for law enforcement, corporations, and private citizens. John's post even caught the attention of tech pioneer and Apple co-founder Steve Wozniak. Thanks to Wozniak's generous backing and funds from EFF's own tech guru, John Gilmore, Electronic Frontier Foundation started making legal representations weeks before the organization was fully established. Today, EFF is the leading nonprofit defending civil liberties in the digital sphere, and Nash is their managing director of advocacy.
Which means that I work very closely with our activism team, our press team, and also with our development team. A lot of the issues that we deal with are very complicated, whether it's from the legal side or the technology side or the policy side, and making sure that it's accessible to the folks who it needs to be. The people who were impacted by our work in 1990 and who are aware of our work in 1990 is a much smaller segment of the population than the people who are impacted by our work in 2023. Technology, every year, it becomes more and more an integral part of everything that we do. And so it's constantly a job of are we reaching those folks? Are we making sure that we're hearing from the folks who are impacted? Are we centering them in these conversations, right? And so that's kind of where a lot of my work is.
When you think of advocacy, what does it mean to you? Advocacy is one of those words that makes its way into a lot of conversations, especially in the nonprofit space. But what does it actually mean to be an advocate for something? Depending on your background, your education, your own unique perspective, it's possible that the term hits you differently than how it hits others. Here's what the word means to Nash as a managing director for advocacy.
So, you know, at one point when I was in high school, I was working in our office. And so I probably shouldn't have been, but I ended up looking at my own file that had like followed me through my my time in school. And like, I think it was second grade. One of my teachers left a note that was like, Nathan is very concerned with making sure that things are fair, whether they concern him or not. And I think that is a good example of what advocacy is, right? And it's like, whether you're personally impacted or by it or not, making sure that you're like, your work is to make sure that you're lifting up the voices and creating the best opportunity for the concerns that need to be addressed are addressed in a way that's responsible.
It's funny because the teacher was probably writing that with a bit of a slap, like mind your own business, right? But you remember it and wear it as a badge of honor today.
Oh, yeah. No, like I would definitely like the whether it concerns him or not was certainly like, I wish he would just shut up, like, you know, but I haven't shut up. And, you know, she wasn't wrong, I'm sure.
It's clear to Nash that advocacy requires action. He has a sense of justice, of what's right and what's wrong, and then acts on those beliefs and values to help others in need. But in addition to action, successful advocacy needs thoughtful compassion and empathy. Championing the rights and needs of individuals or groups who are vulnerable, threatened, or disenfranchised requires a more profound understanding of what it's like to walk in their shoes. Nash's experience as an activist and even as a civilian have shaped his sense of justice and what it means to advocate for others.
There was a period of time where I was getting pulled over by the police literally every single day. For no reason, reasons that were completely fabricated. And so that was the case. I've been a victim of police violence. I have a scar in my head from an interaction with when an officer decided to become particularly violent. As a Black man in America, that is something that is unavoidable. There are moments when it's still a slap, but there's also like, there's a lot of times when it's almost like water, right? It's like, if you're a fish, you're going to tell, you know, you're trying to tell the fish to explain water. Like, it's the only reality I've ever had. An interesting, like, kind of example of how it becomes like water. There are times when I began becoming a legal organizer and I was dealing with like young activists who came from positions of privilege in many different ways. And they would talk about like, you know, I was in jail and they didn't give us any water. It was super cold in there. Like, and like just the way the officers would teach, would speak to them and treat them and just how dehumanizing it was. But honestly, like because of my own experiences, I was like, well, of course it was like that. It was jail. My first response was like, yeah, what are you complaining about? And then having to realize that like, just because like my and others' experience might be worse, that doesn't mean that the thing you're talking about is not completely wrong. Like it is. You shouldn't be dehumanized that way in that way, right? We end up moving our like expectations of what is just and what's right and what should be expected in ways that are become invisible to us, right? And then so it's those moments where I had to like have that wake up moment and be like, oh yeah, you're right. That is wrong. It's not just because it's not as wrong, right? It doesn't mean it's not wrong.
Nash encountered another wake-up call on his advocacy journey. EFF's litigation continues to have a major impact, and their grassroots activism, policy analysis, and technology development are stellar. But Nash points to another, less visible element that's required to bring real and lasting change.
I think there's absolutely a greater awareness, like more folks that I meet now than even 5 years ago or 6 years ago, understand the issues of privacy. I had to spend more time sharing why they were important than I do now, right? Like actually, like when Edward Snowden released, you know, all the documents that he released, I remember the group I was organizing with at the time had to host an event that we called Nothing to Hide, So Much to Lose, right? Because so many people were like, oh, I have nothing to hide. It's like, yeah, but that's not the point though. It's a really important discussion to continue to have. But less folks are concerned about like whether or not it's important. What I do see more and more of is kind of a folks are not feeling as empowered, or that they are, that there's something that they can do about it, right? There's a little bit of a fatigue, right? I talk about Occupy Wall Street. One of the things that I think that we failed at, right, is like we got folks really upset and then we didn't tell them what to do about it, right? And whereas like, I think that that's the important part now is like, and everything that I write and everything that the folks that I work with, it's always like so important to me that like, there has to be the thing to do, right? There has to be like, okay, it's not just like, this bill is horrible. It's going to have all that. What do we do about it, right? And so it has to be empowering. I think that's the thing. Folks are more aware, but there's a level of fatigue and there's also a level of disempowerment in that knowledge. That's the challenge, right? Making sure that folks aren't just aware, but that they feel like there's something they can do.
Nash is highlighting a significant generational shift that many nonprofits today miss. Your supporters and advocates want to be involved and connected in ways that go beyond financial support alone. In fact, when nonprofits provide low barrier opportunities for stakeholders to get involved, they increase donor retention and investment by deepening the connection their donors have to the mission that they financially support. By offering a strong call to action and invitation to meaningful engagement beyond giving alone, you amplify your success and make the difference between heightened donor involvement and diminished interest. But as we learned earlier, you need to nurture empathy for your supporters and guard against inviting them into opportunities that might ultimately be detrimental or even dangerous to their security or safety.
I know that I have the privilege of being a U.S. citizen, right? And which means that if I'm involved in protests in the U.S., like it is not going to affect my residency here, right? Whereas like if there's folks who are undocumented or otherwise, like if they get involved in protests, they could literally like lose their ability to live here anymore and or to be with their families or what have you. There's this like kind of gut reaction. You're like, oh, well, I'm going to tell those folks not to do this thing then because the potential for harm for them is so much greater. And I realized, you know, there's in New York, there's a group called the Laundry Workers Center, I believe. And it was largely undocumented folks that were organizing for, you know, workers' rights. And at one point there were folks who in, you know, in New York would say like, hey, you guys shouldn't come to this action. These things could happen. And like, they were like, no, we understand the risks to us, but we also understand that we're impacted by it. And so we're going to make the informed choices. And so it's a matter of like making sure that people have all of the information that they need and that you're providing the safety mechanisms and protection mechanisms. So maybe in that case, I'm making sure that we have immigration attorneys and we have other legal support ready for them if they need it, but I'm not going to tell them not to do it. I'm going to make sure they have the information that they need to make those informed choices and to be able to advocate for themselves and in the way that feels right to them.
Nash and his team at EFF are empowering people, offering them information, opportunity, and support if or when they need it. The issues they campaign and litigate on affect us all, like surveillance and privacy, social media moderation, online content restrictions for children. The list is endless. How they help people to make informed choices, how they provide tools to empower and support is important because their decisions and how they go about taking action can impact lives in big and unintended ways.
We start from a position like something you'll hear frequently at EFF is like, we don't have to be first, we have to be right. You know, and so like that's like really something that we try to internalize here. It's like, do we actually know the problem? And do we know the potential unintended consequences? That's the thing that like, you know, whenever like we have battles or like where we have disagreements with other folks in our space, it's often because like there's like, it's like, that sounds like the right solution, but have you thought about like, what are the things that could happen that are unintended consequences of if we do that? And so like, when first thing we do is like, what is the real clock here? It's a big news moment that like, that folks are trying to grab onto that doesn't really have a clock in a meaningful way, right? That we could actually like take a couple of weeks and like think about it, think it through and like write about it and share about it and engage with it in a way that's like really intentional. Or like, you know, and other times, you know, there's like, we find out about something like they're going to make a vote and they're going to sell the .org extension to some, you know, venture capitalist or what have you. And it's like, and if we don't do anything by this board meeting on this day, then it's over with. And then there's a real clock, right? And you have to be able to like, both like take the time think it through and like figure out who are the other folks outside of the room who may have perspectives that will help us to make the mixed reform choice and who it can help us activate and respond to it. But really it's first like taking that breath, like we're not a breaking news agency, right? We're advocates and we're activists and we're, you know, litigators and what have you. And so we really want to make sure that when we say it, it's because we've thought about it, right? In the most thoughtful way that we can, you know, given the time constraints. Largely time is not as much of an issue as folks might want you to think it is.
We're so accustomed to hearing about the speed and agility, like Facebook's retired mantra, move fast and break things, which has become the unofficial mantra of our digital age. In this fast-moving era, it's encouraging to know that Nash and his colleagues move deliberately and intentionally and even slowly. And trust is the key ingredient of their productive advocacy. Whatever your identity, whatever your cause, being a trustworthy source is a valuable commodity in today's world.
There definitely have been times over the year when I look at like other organizations and I'm like, oh, they got on that so quick. Too frequently, I'm also like, oh, but look at that's not right and that's wrong. Like, you know, and like, and it's funny, like Hassan Abi, who is a, you know, influencer, I think, and somebody sent me a clip of his Twitch stream from a week or two ago. And he's like reading from an EFF article and he goes, you know, and this from the EFF, they're pretty legit. And like, I want everyone to say they're pretty legit. Like when we come out with something, I want people to know like, okay, that's probably the right point. You know, like I may not always agree with them, but they're probably right. So to me, like it's that sustained credibility. And the fact that like there's folks on both sides of the aisle and like multiple political, you know, whether it be liberal anarchists or libertarians, a lot of folks know, like they trust our position and they trust our opinion on them because they know that we've looked at it from like the broadest perspective possible. Even though in the moment it might feel like, oh, we're a little bit late on this thing, over 30 years, it's been the right decision.
Being trustworthy, being legit is vital, not only when it comes to activism and advocacy, but it's also essential when it comes to engaging with donors. The majority of EFF's donations come from individual and modest contributions. By cultivating a high level of trust, they can enlist a wider donor base. But how do you sustain donor engagement with individuals of such diverse interest and background?
I wouldn't say that we know the answer, but we do have like a lot of folks who have been supporting our work for a long time. And again, I think it's because they know that we're reliable and we're consistent, right? Sometimes we might be addressing an issue that's not the issue that brought them into EFF, but we're like always willing and we try to make sure that we're making the connection so that they know that like, this is why like the thing that you care about is connected to this, right? And so for instance, like one of the things that I often say, because there's certainly within EFF, there's a desire to make sure like, is our membership represented of all the folks that are impacted by our work. And right now it's not entirely, right? A lot of the folks who originally were aware of the impacts of technology were like now older white dudes, right? Our membership does skew that way. And we want to make sure that we are continuously working to have a broader representation in our donor base, right? Because that's who we're accountable to. But it is important for us too, that like, as we're like, making sure we're speaking to broader and broader amounts of folks. We're also making sure that the folks who have been supporting us forever understand that like all of the work that we do is still tied to that main mission, right? Of like protecting your rights in the digital world. And there's, as technology impacts more and more areas of our lives, that's going to mean broader things, right? But if the information that you share online, if the apps that you're downloading are sharing information in ways that could potentially put you and your family at risk, that is a digital rights issue, right? And so the ways that technology is impacting the ability for people to make the wisest health choices that they can, right? That is a digital rights issue. And so it's a matter of like continuing to make sure that our work is impactful and we're messaging it so it's accessible to all the people impacted by it, but also making sure that our core donor base understands that like, this is still very much in line and very much in keeping with the reason that you supported EFF to begin with.
As they look at how we use technology and how it can truly serve everyone, EFF is working hard to make sure their efforts and priorities are aligned. By being attentive to users' needs and considering the best course of action, they're building a strategy that allows them to stay effective for another 30 years and beyond.
Every one of us is engaging in technology every single day, and technology is improving our ability to communicate with each other. It's increasing the scope of information that's available to us, but it can also have negative impacts and it can be chilling of our ability to do those things. So that's why EFF is so important, because we have kind of a three-pronged approach, we have attorneys that engage in impact litigation. We have our activist team that works with our 30,000 members to be able to push for the best policies possible. And we have our technologists that provide both like the technological expertise to support both of those teams, but also create tools like Privacy Badger and HTTPS Everywhere that create real protections where legal protections are not efficient, right? We're able to look at a problem and really dissect and have robust conversations about what is the right solution, not just assume that the hammer that we have must be the right tool for that nail when that's not even a nail. Being able to have an organization that is supporting your rights in the world and really from a thoughtful and multi-expertise strategy is really like where we shine and why I do think that our existence is critical.
Before we go, Nash has one key piece of advice for nonprofit leaders, and it involves approaching advocacy through the lens of diversity, inclusion, equity, and belonging.
It's also a relevancy and an efficacy and an efficiency. An example that I've heard used before is like the concentric circles of power within restaurant organizing in New York City, right? So when front of the house restaurant workers, I think him actually came out of the Windows of the World organizers, you know, the Windows of the World used to be a restaurant on top of the World Trade Center, and went after, you know, the tragedy there, they were organizing and trying to pull in, trying to say like, how can we create a system that empowers everyone that works here, right? And they really thought of like, they thought of the outward ring of the concentric circles of power as the largely South American folks at that time that were working in the kitchen, right? And so they wanted to make sure, like, how we build a system of power that empowers those folks. And what they didn't recognize was like, who wasn't in the folks, there were no women working in the front of the house. So as they built this system that was being able to support those folks most effectively, they ended up getting like these friction points, right? And like the things that they were doing weren't as effective as they thought they would be. And it was because like as they created more opportunities, they brought in new folks who hadn't been in the room before, and the systems that they built did not work to help them effectively, right? And so then they were like, why don't these things ever work? And it's because you never thought about those folks that weren't there, right? And so similarly also, you know, and so I think about that as really important. It's like, who's not in the room, and are we thinking about the ways these decisions are going to impact them. Your work, if you're doing it right, is going to continue to expand, and the people who it reaches and the people who it impacts are going to continue to expand, and are you going to want them to, right? And if those folks don't see themselves represented, if they don't see their own interests represented, then why would they support you? And why would they believe and trust that the positions or the solutions that you're putting forward are going to work for them?
As technology filters into every aspect of our lives, EFF's mission is more urgent and necessary today than it was at its founding 3 decades ago. Let's recap what we can learn from Nash and EFF's vital work. First, advocacy means action, but it also needs to empower. Without tools or solutions that empower everyday people, advocacy will fall short of making real and meaningful change. Next, advocacy needs to be built on a trustworthy foundation. If you want to bring people together to collaborate and to create change, start by building a foundation of trust. Do that before you launch a project or before you get the work underway. From the very start, aim to win them over by building trust. Third, as a leader and as a team, ask yourselves this question: do you want to be first or do you want to be right? Your answer has consequences, especially when it comes to trust, so make it intentionally. Finally, your organization's most powerful asset is your people. And to truly harness this asset, take the time to consider who's not in the room. Whichever path you choose, whatever service you build, think about whose voice is not represented. Then go deeper and ask the harder questions. Why aren't they here? How might they be included? And what's at stake if we don't take action now to change the voices in the room? I'm Ted Vaughn, and this is Future Nonprofit. If you want to hear more stories from experts in the industry like Nash to learn how to take your nonprofit into the future, subscribe to the podcast and visit makehistoric.com.
Future Nonprofit is a production of Lower Street and Historic Agency. Produced by Mark Miller, Ben Crannell, James Bladel, and Ted Vaughn. Edited by Ben Crannell. Visit futurenonprofit.com for a transcript of this episode.